KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky did not sign the mineral deal President Trump has been pushing for after their blow-up at the White House. What's the view from Moscow as the U.S. warms to Russia? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, Israel blocks aid into Gaza as the first phase of the ceasefire ends. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. There's no agreement yet on what comes next as Israel proposes a new plan without Hamas buy-in. Also, how the firings of federal workers could affect weather reports. And early results are in from our stress-less study, tips for how you can cut down everyday anxiety. It's Monday, March 3rd. Happy birthday to Ron Chernow, who wrote the biography of Alexander Hamilton that inspired the hit musical. He turned 76. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Nearly 20 European leaders gathered in London over the weekend to meet Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and pledge support for his country. The gatherings came after Zelensky held a fiery meeting last Friday in Washington with President Trump. That's where Trump publicly criticized Zelensky and demanded more gratitude. NPR's Lauren Freyer says the Ukrainian leader spoke to journalists as he left Britain.
Speaking in Ukrainian, Zelensky dodged questions about apologizing to Trump, but said he would never insult anybody and is thankful for U.S. support. He said it's wrong to discuss, at least at this stage, the idea of giving up territory Russia has taken, and that he's still willing to sign a minerals deal that would give the U.S. access to some of Ukraine's natural resources.
NPR's Lauren Freyer reporting. President Trump is set to deliver an address to a joint session of Congress tomorrow, but a new NPR, PBS News Marist poll finds Americans are against many of the things Trump is trying to do. NPR's Domenico Montanaro has more.
President Trump has claimed a mandate several times since being elected and has tried to do a lot in the little more than a month since he was sworn in. But a majority of the nearly 1,700 respondents in the survey said they think Trump is moving too quickly and not considering the consequences of what he's doing in trying to reshape the government. Trump gets a 45% approval rating and just 34% from independents. When it comes to DOGE, the informal Department of Government Efficiency headed by Elon Musk, just 39% have a favorable opinion. It raises the stakes for Trump's speech tomorrow, but it also could be a warning sign for next year's midterm elections for Republicans, especially if independents continue to say they oppose what Trump is doing. Domenico Montanaro, NPR News, Washington.
A senior official at the U.S. Agency for International Development was suddenly put on leave yesterday. Nicholas Enrich had just issued a memo. In it, Enrich contradicted claims by the Trump administration. He said political leadership will make it impossible to deliver life-saving U.S. aid around the world. He says DOGE has blocked payment methods to deliver the aid. Stocks opened lower this morning as investors prepare for possible tariffs on imports from Canada and Mexico. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 30 points in early trading.
President Trump has threatened to impose a 25% tariff on imports from the country's northern and southern neighbors starting tomorrow. But Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick told Fox News the situation is still fluid. Trump held off imposing tariffs last month in exchange for some border security measures. Lutnick also told Fox he's considering a change in the way his department calculates gross domestic product, so government spending would not be counted. The move, which could mask the effect of spending cuts, would be a break from both longstanding practice and international norms. The CEO of grocery giant Kroger has abruptly resigned. Rodney McMullen, who started his career as a bag boy, is stepping down after an investigation into personal conduct. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
It's NPR. Wildfires have been burning over the weekend in the Carolinas. South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster has declared a state of emergency. The largest brush fire is burning near the South Carolinian coastal city of Myrtle Beach. There are blizzard warnings up for parts of Colorado and Nebraska today. These come ahead of a major winter storm that's plowing into the plains. Some areas in the upper Midwest could see as much as a foot of fresh snow this week. The independent film Anora took home most of the big prizes at the 97th Academy Awards. NPR's Bob Mondello has details.
Anora, an R-rated Cinderella story, was nominated for 6 Oscars and took home 5, including Best Picture. Filmmaker Sean Baker ended up making 4 separate trips to the stage to accept awards for his original screenplay, his editing, his directing, and for Best Picture. The film also won Best Actress for its star Mikey Madison, who plays a Brooklyn sex worker whose life gets complicated after she marries the son of a Russian oligarch.
I love my husband.
You do not know this guy.
We are consenting adults.
Made for just $6 million, Anora has so far taken in about $40 million worldwide. Other films winning multiple Oscars were The Brutalist, with three, including Best Actor Adrian Brody, and Dune Part Two, Wicked, and Emilia Perez, each with two. Bob Mondello, NPR News.
The Best Supporting Actress Award went to Zoe Saldana for her role in Emilia Perez, and the Best Supporting Actor Award to Kieran Culkin for A Real Pain. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In a few minutes, we're going to look ahead to President Trump's speech to Congress tomorrow night. And we're wondering what the theatrics during the 2020 State of the Union can tell us about what we might expect.
But first, what is Russia's view of the shifting U.S. policy toward its ally, Ukraine? A Kremlin spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov, says it aligns pretty closely with Russia's vision. The statement comes after an explosive meeting at the White House between President Trump and Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. It was supposed to end with the signing of a deal to co-develop Ukraine's rare earth minerals. That didn't happen. Now the UK, France, and Ukraine are rushing to create an alternative deal to President Trump's with more security guarantees. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer says they will then present their plan to the United States. Here's how he closed an emergency meeting of European leaders yesterday.
We are at a crossroads in history today. This is not a moment for more talk. It's time to act, time to step up and lead, and to unite around a new plan for a just and enduring peace.
For insight into how all of this is being viewed from Russia, we're joined by Nina Khrushcheva. She's a professor of international affairs at the New School in New York City and the great-granddaughter of Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to start with what you think the Kremlin was thinking as President Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance berated Zelensky in the White House.
Well, the Kremlin is ecstatic. The Kremlin didn't even have to do anything this time around, and the West is being suddenly ripped apart, and Zelensky, the Kremlin obviously doesn't like and thinks an enemy, is being berated by the United States, by Donald Trump, who the Kremlin does like. So it does seem that it's a great dream of any KGB operative to see the West unraveling this way, without even having to lift a finger in this particular moment. What real results, will there be actual real results, actual results for the war ending? It's not clear how well it's going to play out in the Kremlin, but in terms of clandestine operation or not clandestine operation, but useful for Putin in seeing the West divided, it's a very good day.
Let's talk about the actual deal that President Trump has been pushing for, this rare minerals deal. Now, the argument is that this deal would prevent further Russian aggression in Ukraine because the U.S. would have a significant economic investment there. What do you make of that argument?
Well, it is possible that that's the case. I mean, imagining that the Russians are going to attack American workers is, at this point at least, inconceivable. So from an economic standpoint, potentially Trump does have a point. And Trump does think in terms of economy, in terms of a large corporation, in terms of the leader of that corporation. So his assessments are much less political and much more political economy in a sense. So it is potentially viable, but obviously Ukraine does want to have much greater guarantees than just economic workers or engineers on the ground in Ukraine.
Now, one of the big criticisms of this effort by President Trump to get a deal done with Russia is that he's making concessions to Russia before negotiations have begun. And that includes reports that the Pentagon is stopping offensive cyber operations against Russia. What is Putin's take right now on this rare minerals deal with the U.S., between the U.S. and Ukraine, and U.S. moves like what we're seeing from the Pentagon?
Well, what we saw with the mineral deals is that Putin very quickly himself said that Russia has rare earth metals and it's much larger territory, and therefore, if we're interested in economic cooperation, obviously we can suggest that Russia also could be a partner. And I think that's what also Trump wants and Trump likes, is because he can get money from Russia if that works out. And Russia is big, and Russia can offer something economically. But with Ukraine, Trump feels he needs to give, and he doesn't like giving, obviously, as a, once again, leader or corporation. In terms of all these other concessions that are being made, they're a bit beyond me, because it does seem that even if you're favorable towards Russia, there is still long-term interests of the United States here in cyber. Cybersecurity is important, and we heard that, yes, of course, cybersecurity is the American priority. At the same time, there must be some sort of conversation in terms of Russia is not going to cyber attack anything, and so the United States is going to be reciprocal, but I don't know the details of this, and also I would be very careful actually trusting Vladimir Putin in any promises if they're just made informally.
I want to talk about the Europeans' alternative deal. I mean, they're suggesting British and European peacekeeping troops in Ukraine. Would this be a deal breaker for Putin?
So far, he said that it will be. But what's interesting is that it seems that the ultimate agreement in London wasn't that different from what Trump, all the very kind of discombobulatedly offered, that first it's the ceasefire, and then we'll think about other security guarantees. So in some ways, actually, we heard Mark Rutte, the General Secretary of NATO, almost saying the same thing. Emmanuel Macron said there will be ceasefire, and in a month they will be peacekeepers. So we'll see how they much agree on the peacekeeping. It could be a deal breaker, or Trump can actually push it towards Putin if Putin gets other concessions.
And really quickly, I mean, you mentioned that Putin likes Trump, and Trump has positioned himself as a mediator to end Russia's war in Ukraine. Do you think this is what Russia wanted all along?
Putin he waits. He's very carefully waiting for things to break down. And that's exactly what has been happening. It's been 3 years of war. Mm-hmm. Trump comes in, and now there's an entirely different Western outlook on this war. And that's what Putin has been waiting for.
Nina Khrushcheva is a professor of international affairs at the New School. Thank you for joining the program.
Thank you.
President Trump is known for bringing a showman's flair to the presidency. Ahead of his address to a joint session of Congress tomorrow, NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith takes us back to Trump's first term and his last State of the Union address in February of 2020.
Before President Trump said a single word, the night was off to a contentious start. Then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi reached out for a handshake, but Trump left her hanging. Soon, Republicans were chanting, four more years. It was an election year, and Trump was both embattled and riding high. The next day, the Senate would vote to acquit Trump in his first impeachment. He never mentioned it, but impeachment hung over the chamber that night. Stephen Groves was a deputy press secretary in the White House at the time.
There was no way to divorce the political realities of what President Trump was going through during that very time from the State of the Union speech.
These addresses are usually pretty predictable. A recitation of accomplishments, an update on the economy and foreign affairs, with a few new proposals thrown in for good measure. What Trump unspooled over the next hour plus was part reality TV, part game show, and part WWE SmackDown. Former Democratic Congresswoman Sherry Bustos was in the chamber that night.
It was drama-filled. You never knew what was going to come out of the president's mouth. And it was like a State of the Union like no other.
There were the traditional guests in the First Lady's box, but Trump added the element of surprise for a girl from Philadelphia.
But Janiyah, I have some good news for you.
Trump handed out a scholarship to attend a private school.
And you will soon be heading to the school of your choice.
And there was an emotional tribute to conservative talk radio personality Rush Limbaugh, who had recently been diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. Again, Stephen Groves.
And the unspoken thing was this was likely to be the last State of the Union that Rush was going to be around for. He was that sick. And so that was the moment that everyone expected.
What no one expected was what came next. Trump awarded Limbaugh the Presidential Medal of Freedom right then and there.
I will now ask the First Lady of the United States to present you with the honor, please.
He later recognized Amy Williams from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, a military spouse.
Amy's kids haven't seen their father's face in many months.
He thanked her for her family's service, and then came the made-for-TV reveal.
But Amy, there is one more thing. Tonight we have a very special surprise. I am thrilled to inform you that your husband is back from deployment. He is here with us tonight, and we couldn't keep him waiting any longer.
The family embraced as everyone in the chamber cheered.
The drama of it and the performance of it.
Donna Hoffman is a political scientist at the University of Northern Iowa. Her specialty is the State of the Union, something she says should be a little bit boring. But she says Trump's approach is more performative.
It really is very much like a wild card. It has got the flavor of a State of the Union address, but then there's that added extra thing there of really kind of inserting that reality television aspect to it.
And my fellow Americans, the best is yet to come. Thank you.
And then in another made-for-TV moment, Nancy Pelosi, who had been seated behind Trump, picked up her printed copy of the remarks and theatrically ripped them in half. As Trump prepares to return to the chamber, Groves says the political dynamics are remarkably different.
He is coming in 2025, riding the wave of winning the popular vote and both the House and the Senate being in Republican hands.
What might Trump's message be this time?
Get on board or get out of the way.
Bustos expects the unexpected.
I think there will be more breaking of norms. I think he will continue to play to the cameras. Who knows what we'll see this time, but I'll give President Trump credit. He is not boring.
The TV ratings for Trump's 2020 address were actually the lowest of his first term. But all those viral moments meant it had reach well beyond those who tuned in. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, how life can change in a second. Writer Hanif Qureshi's first film, 1985's My Beautiful Laundrette, starred Daniel Day-Lewis and won Qureshi an Oscar for Best Screenplay. In 2022, he fell, and when he regained consciousness, his limbs were paralyzed. We'll talk about life before and after the fall. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. From Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits, at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. Staff cuts at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration could interrupt the weather forecasts many Americans rely on. Several hundred NOAA employees have been fired. NPR's Alejandra Barunda reports.
Did you check the weather on your phone this morning? If you did, you interacted with NOAA.
What NOAA does really is they support pretty much every American every day in a positive way.
That's retired Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet. He led NOAA during the first Trump administration. He says the agency is most visible during weather emergencies.
Like during hurricane season, when the National Hurricane Center is putting out the well-publicized graphics of hurricane tracks, projected track, but also daily weather warnings that every American gets.
NOAA also helps manage the country's ocean fisheries. It creates nautical charts that keep ships from running aground. It protects species like whales and corals. It tracks space weather that can endanger commercial airlines. The firings last week hit every part of the agency. Gallaudet called it a sledgehammer approach.
There's a smarter way to do this. I don't think you need to slash and burn NOAA or any federal agency.
Rick Spinrad led NOAA during the Biden administration. He says,
if you degrade the capability for predicting landfall of hurricanes or timing of tornadoes or severity of fire, flood, or drought, there would be consequences both to property and lives, as well as probably more crop damage.
Spinrad says the fallout from the staff cuts could also lead to economic pain, like disruptions to the multi-trillion-dollar marine shipping industry or offshore fishing. But the cuts could go deeper still. The Trump administration has asked for even more staff cuts from NOAA and other federal agencies. NOAA has not responded to NPR's request for comment. For NPR News, I'm Alejandra Borunda.
Anybody feeling a little stressed out? You know, a little? Well, last fall, NPR's Stress Less series taught us some strategies to help reduce anxiety. After hearing it, thousands of people signed up to try out those skills and be part of a research study at Northwestern University. Now that the preliminary results are in, NPR's Allison Aubrey has more on what worked best.
People who signed up were taught a series of 8 skills. Among them was learning to focus on positive events and savor them. Joanna Littow is one of the Morning Edition listeners who says she was all in. She's a baby boomer who lives in Anchorage, Alaska, where this time of year, melting snow can create a slushy brown grit of salt and grime around the streets.
Driving around town during the day, it's cold, it's mundane, but I just, you know, just lift my eyes up and look at the mountains.
Everywhere she looks, there's scenic views with the snow-covered Chugach Mountains as a backdrop.
I rest my eyes on the mountains, and it is so soothing. You know, the light, how it plays on the snow on the mountains, you know, it's just gorgeous.
The next skill she tried is called positive reappraisal. So instead of grumbling about work, she's now more focused on what she likes about her job. Part of what she does is set up banquets, and she interacts with a lot of people, which suits her personality.
Look at me. I have a job to go to that provides me stability, security, and I get to go to work and others don't get to go to work, and they wish they could go to work.
The little ways that Littal changed her mindset is exactly what researcher Judith Moskowitz of Northwestern University had hoped for. She developed the program and conducted the study. Overall, she says people who took part had significantly more positive emotions and improved in many different ways.
Less anxiety, less depression, less sleep disturbance, less social isolation, and increases in positive affect.
She says Joanna Littal's story illustrates how the skills can help.
This absolutely fits with what we saw in the numbers coming out of the study. And it's so exciting to hear people actually talk about how they're using the skills and how they're putting them into practice in their lives.
One of the most striking findings from the study is that participants' sense of self-efficacy increased, which means they started to believe more in their own ability to set a goal and accomplish it, which Moskowitz says can go hand in hand with feeling more positive.
It's an upward spiral where you maybe take the first step. You feel some progress towards your goal, which increases your positive emotion, which then feeds back and helps you take the next step.
Dr. Samir Sinha is a geriatrician at Sinai Health System in Toronto. He says he's not surprised that teaching these skills led to such improvements.
Stress reduction tools, I think, need to be thought of as an important habit. Almost the idea that you have kind of stress management hygiene tools that you can actually use.
A lot of the skills taught in the course are things people have heard before. Like positive reappraisal is another way of saying, turn your frown upside down, something even young children understand. Dr. Sinha says, in the swirl of demands and worries that come with adult life, especially at times of uncertainty, we tend to forget to take time to notice the good. That's why it's important to try to build these skills into habits.
I think once people practice them and realize how much better their outlook is, it almost becomes addictive. You're almost like, wow, this is actually how I should be approaching things every day.
And the more you practice, the more likely this is to happen. If you missed the study, you can still learn the skills by signing up for our Stress Less newsletter at npr.org. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, we visit a hotel for cows in Colombia, a way to feed and house cattle that cuts down on deforestation. Listen on your smartphone, your smart speaker, or on your radio. This is NPR News.
What happens when a lifelong dream comes true, then slips through your fingers? Olympic gymnast Jordan Chiles knows what that feels like. She won an individual bronze medal in Paris. Just days later, it was revoked.
I felt like every single time I would accomplish something, something would be stripped away from me.
I'm Juana Summers. Jordan Chiles on her new memoir, I'm That Girl, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Russia says it continues to see signs of improved relations with the U.S. under President Trump, and according to the Kremlin, that includes an increasingly shared worldview As NPR's Charles Maines reports.
In an interview on state television, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov noted a dramatic shift in U.S. foreign policy, saying it now, quote, largely aligns with Russian positions. Peskov added that while there was a long way to go to repair relations, the path for a U.S.-Russian thaw could be quick and successful if Russian President Vladimir Putin and President Trump continued to show the political will. The move towards a reset in U.S.-Russian relations has come as President Trump has sought to engage Putin to negotiate an end to the war in Ukraine. The shift in policy has also unnerved Ukraine and traditional American allies in Europe, who fear Trump may cut deals with Moscow at the expense of their collective security. Charles Maines, NPR News.
Dmitry Peskov's remarks come a day after European leaders gathered in London to rally support for Ukraine. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer outlined a plan to bring the war to an end, saying Europe will have to do the heavy lifting for its own security. Police in Germany say they have a suspect in custody after a car rammed into a crowd in the western German city of Mannheim. One person was reported dead. There were injuries, but how many is not clear. Police are asking the public to stay away from the downtown area. This is NPR News. Egg prices have gotten prohibitively expensive for some shoppers, and NPR's Amy Held reports that relief is not expected until well after Easter.
Eggs have long been considered a more bang-for-your-buck nutritional source. Too many bucks, some consumers have decided they can do without that $12 carton. The USDA predicts prices will rise 41% this year.
Oh, it's hurting, man. It's crazy how expensive eggs are.
But Jose Castillo needs them. He manages a bakery in New Orleans.
What really worries me is like not being able to get the product that we need, you know, the eggs, because there is a shortage.
And a shortage of chickens, tens of millions gone as a result of bird flu. The USDA says it plans to spend up to $1 billion in part safeguarding farms from transmission and replacing birds. But officials say it will take time for prices to ease, perhaps not till summer. Amy Held, NPR News.
The Royal Australian Navy says it's rescued a Lithuanian adventurer who was attempting to row across the Pacific Ocean from his starting point in California. A Navy statement says Aramis Mokas was taken aboard an Australian warship today and is undergoing a medical assessment. He had been stranded for 3 days in the Coral Sea after encountering a tropical cyclone. He was attempting to become one of the few rowers who have crossed the Pacific alone and without stopping. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Israel has blocked all aid and supplies into Gaza. That includes food and medical supplies.
The move comes as the first phase of the ceasefire deal with Hamas expired over the weekend. Israel has been pushing for a new plan outside of the original agreement, a plan which Hamas has rebuffed.
For more, we're joined by NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Good morning, Kat.
Good morning.
Okay, so Israel says there's a new plan for the ceasefire. What do we know about where it came from and what is being proposed?
Israel announced this plan yesterday, calling it the Witkoff Plan, and saying that President Trump's Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, came up with it. It's unclear when Witkoff would have presented it. Israel says they've already agreed to it. The plan would extend the first phase of this ceasefire agreement by 50 days. On the first day of that extension, Israel wants Hamas to release half the remaining living hostages and half of the bodies of those who have been killed. And then by the end of the extension, if an agreement to end the war permanently is reached, the remaining live and dead hostages would be released then. Israel reiterated that it has the right to go back to war if those negotiations are ineffective.
And what are you hearing from Hamas? Are they on board with this plan?
No, Hamas has essentially rebuffed the plan. In a statement, the militant group said that Israel is trying to evade the original ceasefire agreement. Just to be clear, this new plan is not the deal that both sides agreed to originally. I'll remind you of what that plan was. It had three phases. The second phase was supposed to be negotiated during the first phase, which didn't happen. Under the second phase, all living hostages are to be released and Israeli forces withdraw from Gaza. And then phase three would see all hostage bodies returned and the start of reconstruction of Gaza, which is expected to take years. Now Israel has introduced this whole new plan, the Witkoff Plan. It's important to note that Hamas has not outright rejected it, but it isn't embracing it either.
So Hamas is not embracing it, as you point out, and in response, Israel has blocked all aid into Gaza. What does that mean exactly?
We're trying to still figure out exactly what it means, but basically Israel has stopped the flow of much needed aid, you know, like food and medical supplies into the enclave. Israel controls what gets in and out of Gaza, and it had allowed a big uptake of aid into Gaza in the past 6 weeks of the ceasefire. But aid and food are still desperately needed there. Aid groups have warned that this blocking of aid violates international law. Other Arab countries have condemned it. The block comes as the Muslim holy month of Ramadan just started over the weekend. Hamas called the decision to stop aid, quote, cheap blackmail, in an attempt to get the group to agree to this new plan.
Okay, so does this mean the ceasefire is broken?
For now, it still appears to be holding. You know, it's fragile and talks are continuing. An official familiar with the details but not authorized to speak publicly told NPR that Israel is, quote, giving it a few days to see where negotiations lead and that Israel is not rushing to return to fighting in Gaza. Witkoff is expected in the region in the coming days. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave a speech last night in English where he thanked President Trump several times. In that speech, he said that Israel will, quote, take further steps if Hamas continues to hold the hostages. He ended saying that he knows America and President Trump have Israel's back to do so.
That's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you.
Israel is also dealing with the potential that Iran could develop nuclear weapons. NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam looks at President Trump's options to ensure that that does not happen.
To hear President Trump tell it, the options for dealing with Iran and its nuclear weapons program are limited. Here he is on Fox News.
There's two ways of stopping them, with bombs or with a written piece of paper.
Last month, Trump signed an executive order to restore his so-called maximum pressure campaign to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon by targeting its oil exports. Trump has said he believes Iran is open to negotiations after suffering a series of military and strategic defeats against Israel. Trump told Fox News, Iran is very concerned.
I think Iran is very nervous. I think they're scared. I think Iran would love to make a deal, and I would love to make a deal with them without bombing them.
During his first term in office, Trump pulled out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. It was a multilateral deal aimed at restricting Iran's nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. It's unclear what kind of deal Trump is looking for this time around, says Dana Stroll, a former Pentagon official now with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Are they going to negotiate only on the nuclear program? Or are they going to also ask Iran to rein in all of its support for these terrorist groups?
Stroll says there's been a shift in Iran's alliances since Trump was last in office. There's a less confrontational relationship with Gulf states, such as Saudi Arabia. Stroll says Tehran has also developed stronger ties to Moscow and Beijing, which were part of the JCPOA.
Russia, China, and Iran have strategically deepened how they work together to circumvent U.S. sanctions. They're increasing their military and defense technology exchanges. They're deepening their commercial interactions.
The other change since Trump was last in office is Iran's nuclear program has advanced.
Iran is today considered a threshold state. It hasn't weaponized, but as reported by intelligence agencies, it's weeks away from weaponizing.
That's Sanam Vakil, an Iran specialist at Chatham House, which is a London-based think tank. She says even though Iran is close to a nuclear weapon, it's more likely to use that as a bargaining chip in negotiations.
It's not in Iran's interest yet to weaponize. I think right now the value of its program is certainly higher because it can use it to negotiate.
Still, last month, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, ruled out negotiations with the U.S. There's a push, especially by Israeli hawks, for Israel and the U.S. to take military action against Iran while it's vulnerable. Stroll says last year, Israel took out Iran's air defenses and, with the help of allies, was able to repel a large missile and drone attack. But Stroll says attacking Iran's nuclear program is a whole different thing.
Taking out an entire nuclear program, which is as geographically distributed as Iran's is and as deeply buried as many parts of Iran's program are, is much more complicated than one night's worth of military strikes.
Syed Hussein Mousavani, a Mideast security and nuclear policy specialist at Princeton University, says it's also a mistake to think that Iran will agree to anything just because it's had a string of setbacks.
Iranians always, they are very sensitive not to negotiate, not to make a deal, as long as the other side has a feeling of weakness on the Iranian side.
Mousavani says Trump should think of Iran like an investment opportunity, especially with the country's vast oil and gas resources.
The real game changer in U.S.-Iran relation is economic engagement. Because Iran has been under sanctions for 40 years and needs trillions of dollars in investment for economic cooperation.
And as Trump has shown, nothing is off the table. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
This is NPR News. A Pakistani-American author asks children to explore what home means. Her book, The Home We Make, is about a hopeful journey of a refugee girl. Next time in Here and Now.
You're about to step out the door. You've got your keys, your wallet, and NPR. If you have your smartphone, we are with you. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, I'm Leila Fadel. The Japanese town of Nagazumi officially has the world's smallest park. It's really just a whisper of grass surrounded by 8 bricks. It's the size of a few sheets of paper. The Guinness ranking dethroned Portland. Its rosebush-sized Millen Park was the reigning champ for decades. Nagazumi staffers vacationed there in the 80s and decided they wanted to go after the prize. Go small and go home, I guess? It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. One of the big winners of last night's Academy Awards was not picked up by any American distributors. Despite that, No Other Land, made by a Palestinian-Israeli collective, claimed the Oscar for documentary feature film. Palestinian filmmaker Basil Adra spoke with Leila back in November.
I always thought that when the people would see what's happening in the videos that I risk my life and other Palestinians risk their lives to film, it would change something.
NPR Entertainment correspondent Madalit Delbarco has more from Oscar night. Good morning.
Good morning.
Or I should probably say good evening because you probably haven't been to bed yet.
Hasn't ended yet.
No. Well, you were in the room when the team behind No Other Land picked up their Oscar. What did they say?
Yeah, well, Basil Adra talked about how he had hoped his daughter would not have to face violence and displacement like he's had to. He spoke out against what he called the ethnic cleansing of Palestinian people. And so did co-director Yuval Abraham, who's an Israeli journalist.
When I look at Basil, I see my brother, but we are unequal. We live in a regime where I am free under civilian law, and Basil is under military laws that destroy his life and he cannot control. There is a different path, a political solution, without ethnic supremacy, with national rights for both of our people.
Abraham said that U.S. foreign policy is helping to block that path. But most of the Oscars ceremony was apolitical, except for just a couple of moments, like this one from host Conan O'Brien talking about the success of the film Anora. It's the story of a Brooklyn sex worker who marries the son of a Russian oligarch.
I guess Americans are excited to see somebody finally stand up to a powerful Russian.
That film, Anora, went on to win Best Picture.
Not just picture, but I am seeing that it was the big winner of the night. Was that a surprise, Mandalit?
Well, Anora had been one of the front runners going into the ceremony, so it wasn't that much of a surprise. Although maybe a bit for Mikey Madison, who beat out Demi Moore and Fernanda Torres when she won the Lead Actress Award. She thanked sex workers for sharing their stories. And so did director Sean Baker, who also wrote, edited, and produced the movie. You know, he's been such an indie filmmaker, but here he was at the most Hollywood of ceremonies, winning 4 Oscars for the same film. During his speech, Baker made a pitch for going to the movies.
Watching a film in the theater with an audience is an experience. We can laugh together, cry together, scream and fight together, perhaps sit in devastated silence together. And in a time in which the world can feel very divided, this is more important than ever. It's a communal experience you simply don't get at home.
Yeah, that was interesting. But still, the Oscars is a show about movies, but made for television. So, Madalit, what kind of show did they put on last night?
Yeah, well, the ceremony kicked off with Ariana Grande and Cynthia Erivo singing a medley of songs from The Wizard of Oz, The Wiz, and Wicked. And the Oz theme continued with Queen Latifah singing another song from The Wiz during a tribute to Quincy Jones. There was also a tribute to James Bond movies and a salute to Los Angeles and those who recently fought the devastating wildfires here. There were other notable winners and a few firsts. Brazil won its first international feature film award for I'm Still Here. And Paul Tazewell from Wicked became the first Black man to win the Oscar for costume design. I was watching the ceremony from inside the theater, but apparently some live stream viewers didn't get to see everything. I hear that Hulu glitched for some of the millions watching from home.
Well, I did it the old school way. I watched it in my kitchen on the TV. Thanks, Mandalit.
Thank you.
That is NPR's Mandalit Delbarco. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
Thank you.
New details on what a U.S. government crypto reserve might look like.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bank of America. Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. Hundreds of billions of dollars flowed into cryptocurrency markets in the last 24 hours or so after a Sunday morning post from President Donald Trump named 5 digital tokens to be included in a national reserve. One reason the president gave was to elevate the crypto industry. The president's announcement comes ahead of a planned crypto summit at the White House on Friday. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more.
The 5 cryptocurrencies President Trump named are Bitcoin, Ether, XRP, Solana, and Cardano. It's unclear whether there might be others as well.
It's significant. It's the first time that he's talked about including more than Bitcoin in the reserve.
David Krause is Emeritus Professor of Finance at Marquette University and has written extensively about cryptocurrencies. He says the less familiar tokens Trump mentioned are designed for specific transactional purposes and make sense to include in a reserve. As for having a crypto reserve at the government level,
gold, oil make more sense as strategic reserves. Their utility values is much greater. Therefore, a strategic reserve of the size we're talking about here is more symbolic.
Trump has pledged to be a crypto-friendly president, and his family holdings include a stake in World Liberty Financial, a crypto platform. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Mortgage rates have been particularly volatile the last couple of years, and that is partly because they are influenced by so many things in the economy that don't always have much to do with buying a house. Treasury bills, inflation, investor mood. Back in 2023, the average 30-year fixed-rate mortgage shot up to almost 8%, highest in 2 decades. Then it came down to a little more than 6% last fall, then up to 7% this year, then started to decline just a little the past few weeks. And despite all the moving around, one thing has been constant. Mortgage rates are high. And, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, they're probably going to stay that way.
Given how much uncertainty there is about inflation, tariffs, and Fed policy right now, Mike Fratantoni at the Mortgage Bankers Association says the watchword for mortgage rates is fluctuation.
There may be times when we're closer to 6. There are going to be times when we're closer to or above 7.
He says the market's gradually adapting to higher mortgage rates. More sellers are putting their homes on the market, and more buyers are realizing
a rate in the low 6s is about as good as you're likely to do.
And what about the recent decline in mortgage rates to 6.75% in the latest report from Freddie Mac? Rose Quint at the National Association of Home Builders says it does improve affordability marginally.
But I think with high home prices, buyers are concerned.
NAHB recently reported that the monthly mortgage on a median-priced home now eats up 38% of a median family's income. Economists consider anything above 30% to be cost-burdened. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow is up about a tenth of a percent, 36 points. The S&P 500 is down less than a tenth of a percent. The NASDAQ is down 3/10 of a percent. The yield on the 10-year treasury is 4.203%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Lisa. Lisa mattresses are designed and assembled in America. Plus, Lisa donates thousands of mattresses a year to shelters and those in need. LEESA.com. And by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot. Learn more about Snapshot at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Snapshot not available in California or from all agents.
Around 20% of the U.S.'s electricity comes from renewables, another 20% from nuclear, but another 40% is from natural gas. Even as renewables have become a bigger part of the supply, so has natural gas. And along with that, so is the delivery of that gas to power plants via pipelines. That is according to the Energy Information Administration. And with electricity demand growing from AC in super hot summers, data centers from EVs, there may well be more demand for more gas pipelines down the road. Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovault has this one.
Our electric grid is getting cleaner. Yes, renewables are doing their part, but so is natural gas.
People have called it a bridge fuel because it is lower CO2 content
than coal. It's pretty flexible in terms of its operations.
Ian Lang with the Colorado School of Mines says natural gas is a handy tool to mix with renewables.
You need a power plant that can sort of either ramp up or ramp down as wind and solar alter what it's doing, like minute to minute. And so gas was seen as very easy to do that.
Natural gas is also plentiful, says University of Houston's Ed Herz.
Natural gas has become the leading resource for electricity generation following the advent of hydraulic fracturing and the tremendous supply of natural gas that we've been able to generate in the U.S.
Natural gas also comes out when you drill for crude oil, which we do a lot of in the U.S. these days. Natural gas is so abundant, it's even driven down electric bills. But Hers says only when that natural gas can get to where it needs to be.
There are a lot of communities around the U.S. that are not getting the cheapest supplies of electricity because they don't have access to natural gas distribution systems.
This is where transmission pipelines and pipeline companies are critical. Tom Sang is with Texas Christian University.
Let's just say you're out in Midland, Texas, and there's all these wells, right? There's hundreds of wells. Well, you don't connect a large pipeline to each well.
You connect them to a single point, and that goes through a giant transmission pipeline. And those transmission pipelines run underground across the country, almost like spider webs, mostly going directly to natural gas-fired power plants. These meet today's electricity demand, but...
As we know, the demand for power is going to go up. We're going to need more natural gas supply, among other things. All right, so the question becomes, will we have to build out new transmission infrastructure to meet those needs?
As we see weather become more extreme and data centers and EVs become more popular, we may see more pipelines down the pipeline. I'm Elizabeth Troval for Marketplace.
And in New York, I'm Sabri Benishour with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.